Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In the race for mayor of Chicago, Paul Vallas has come out swinging, hasn't he? He's realized that this is a political campaign, not some academic conference. And so now he's throwing hard punches right in the teeth of post-Romulan politicians, those inside politicos who are now in the race now that Rom is out, especially Bill Daley, also known as Joe Krapnick to some, and Gary Chico for playing things the Chicago way, for leveraging political clout, making money as lobbyists, and now reaching for that city hall power after Rom pulled the plug. What you'll hear in the interview is anger in Paul Vallas' voice. If they're in it now to serve the people because Chicago is so messed up, why weren't they in before? And Tom Bevin, co-founder and publisher of RealClearPolitics.com, joins us to talk about the fight over the appointment of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and the allegations by Christine Blasey Ford that Kavanaugh assaulted her 36 years ago at a high school party. Democrats want to use this drama to deny him the nomination and, with their friends in the Democratic media complex, convince suburban women that Republicans hate women by not accepting Ford's account as truth. But something's happening. The people she's named as witnesses, two men and a woman, have gone on record saying it didn't happen. Doesn't that matter anymore? So we're going to ask Tom Bevin what this means. Could it be another deplorables moment? And what kind of country do we live in now that accusations alone are regarded as truth? As always, co-host Jeff Carlin, executive producer of WGN's Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis, is here. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And you know where you are, don't you? You're out on that street. Sometimes it's friendly. Sometimes it's just the boulevard of broken taxpayer dreams. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Look, Chicago is in a bona fide death spiral, and that death spiral has been perpetuated by a system in which the political class benefits at the expense of the business class and the communities. Now, you know, the political class creates the belief that if you have the support of one of them or one of their candidates, that's the only way you're going to protect your respective interests. So in this election, the political class is clearly on the ballot. They have many candidates on this ballot that, irrespective of which one of these later rivals win, the only winners are going to be the status quo. The only way to break the cycle is for the press and the various constituents to force candidates to open their kimonos and show their true plans for the city and be cross-examined on how their lives are consistent or inconsistent with their stated objectives. This isn't the business community versus the neighborhoods. The business community and the neighborhoods have been screwed by the political class. This isn't the cops versus the communities. The cops and the communities have been screwed by the political class. We've created conditions within which we have tension, between the cops and the communities because so much of what we've done to the police department has been driven by politics, not driven by the need to provide the investment and the infrastructure and the training and support that the police need to be effective. And the business community is going to be a great casualty in our failure to embrace the type of strategies and programs that benefit all the communities. So we are all victims of this political clash. I mean, we are no more healthier in this city, or for that matter, in this state, than Russia was on the verge of the collapse of the communist system of government. I mean, this is like the Soviet Union on the eve of a collapse. So at the end of the day, voters have got to control their own destiny. And to do that, we've got to make this election a referendum on the status quo. The political class.
So you put Tony Preckwinkle, Gary Chico, Billy Daly, Susana Mendoza, who's going to come in, you put them all in that group.
Well, you know, I put these individuals who are lobbyists and have been lobbyists for many years and have made a fortune through their connections or through their board appointments, and individuals who are in one office now planning on running for a second office when they're months away of getting reelected to their current offices, I would put them in that same category.
Where does the responsibility of the media come in, the political media? Are we covering this as Game of Thrones?
Yeah, you know, I believe they are, because it's more about personality intrigue. It's more about, the behind-the-scenes maneuvering, the Machiavellian. You know, we almost reward the cleverness in somebody who says, well, great, they've cleared out, they have no opposition in this election, they have a clear run for November, but how clever, now they're setting themselves up for the run for the bigger office. I mean, you know, rather than the call for them to either, you know, either withdraw. I mean, look, you know, Tony's the party president. I mean, if she wants to run for mayor, she should withdraw, and they should select another candidate, you know, to basically...
She's not the party president. She's the chairman of the central committee.
Yeah, she's chairman of the central committee. So, I'm sorry about that.
No,
that's right. I mean, there's a reason Daly used to be, Mayor Daly, Daly was chairman of the party, like the party central committee and mayor. It was like, you know, the individual was president of the party secretariat, and, you know, they always held two positions because it was controlling the party. And I mean, literally, to a certain extent, she's taken a page out of the, you know, out of the old man.
And Billy and Chico? Lobbyists, you say.
Well, look, I mean, these are guys who have made a fortune on their political connections. I mean, you've mentioned, you've played the game, the name games. I mean, if Daly's name is, is Krumpke or whatever the name you use, I mean, really.
Krapnik.
I mean, yeah, you know, do you think he would have gotten all these appointments, or he would have gotten that CEO's job at SBC, or, you know, held all those, or be on all those well-paid boards, et cetera? Wouldn't that happen? And look, I mean, you know, Gary didn't want to run things. He wanted to go make money. So he did. He made a lot of money, but he stayed connected to the political establishment, because, you know, what happens is you become like a made guy in this town. Oh, this guy's connected. Why? Because he's on a board. He's on the board. He must be connected. And it's not like they're out there. It's not like they're out there and saying, I'll give you a contract if you give me work. No, what happens is, because they're one of the chosen few, you know, if you're getting work in the city and you want to get work in the city, if you have to hire a law firm, that's where you go. If you have to get your property taxes appealed, you go to the firms that have the biggest clout. If you want a lobbyist or somebody who's going to advocate for your business interests, you go to somebody who's on a board, who's considered to be part of the political establishment.
Nobody comes up and says, give me this and I'll give you that. You don't need a sign. There's no sign. You don't need a sign. You know where there's who's the president of the school board, who's the mayor's brother, right?
Well, think about it for a second.
All these business guys don't need a sign. They don't speak in code. They know what they got to do. There's nobody saying, do this and I'll do that for you. It's out there.
Well, you know, the problem with poor Blagojevich was he was so blatant about it and so stupid about it. I mean, and he's got 14 years. I mean, impeachment and maybe putting him on a work farm for a year would have been more than enough, you know. Yeah. Let the guy go home to his family, for crying out loud. I mean, at the end of the day, he was just stupid about it. But at the end of the day, that's the way that's the way it's been played. People are deaf, quiet. I mean, they find the seams because they create the seams. They create the seams within which they can operate. And politics becomes a means to an end. For some, it's ego. For some, it's money. For some, it's ego and money. You make the money, you know, and then you satisfy your ego.
And what happens to the city?
Well, the city suffers. And again, and it pains me. It pains me to go to Roseland and to walk Michigan Avenue and to walk by Gately People's Store, which was the first Walmart, and to see boarded up buildings, to no State Theater, no Rosen Theater, no Woolworths, no Remblakes, no Studi Youngs, no Carmel Corn Shop, and things like that.
Nothing.
You know, and they have people approach me on the street. This one kid approached me on the street, and he was a homeless kid. You know what I mean? He was a homeless kid, and he was wondering where there might be a shelter that I could recommend. And I remember I gave him $20, and it was as if I gave him $500. And I remembered when I was in Haiti. Where you could give somebody, you know, everybody said, oh, corruption in Haiti. You know, there's so much corruption in Haiti. 95% of the economy is underground. So people scrape for just a few bucks. And if you gave somebody $5 a day, that was enough. That was enough to help them get by 2 days or 3 days. I mean, and you see this stuff, and then you go to communities where you wonder when you see these children, when you see the children on the street. I've begun to wonder, you know, because we have so many children coming from so many poor communities, you know, and they've struggled with learning disabilities or attention deficit disorders and things like that. And you begin to wonder whether the lead in the water that the unions, remember up to 86, the unions, they mandated that you build water, you know, your pipes with lead water. And you begin to wonder how many of these kids have suffered from lead poisoning. I mean, how many of these kids, I mean, you know, they almost become expendable. They become casualties. They become casualties. No one seems to care. You know what I mean? So, you know, you just see areas of extraordinary neglect in this city, and you have to ask yourself, how on God's good earth can we continue to embrace a political infrastructure that perpetuates these inequities, that perpetuates the status quo, and it's an infrastructure within which people are getting rich off of, and sure, you have your professional politicians, and obviously you have some professional politicians like a Toni Prekwick who hasn't enriched herself, but then you also have professional politicians who are making a fortune while they're holding those political offices, but then you have those lobbyists that drift in and out of the political system and profiting. I mean, it's not the business versus the communities. It's not the police versus the neighborhoods. It's the businesses and the communities and the police and the neighborhoods versus the political combine. And the election has got to be about shaking up this system. And the only way you're going to do it is by changing the status quo. And the only way you're going to change the status quo is to vote for a candidate that is not a part and parcel, an extension of that system.
Who is that candidate?
Well, I consider myself to be that candidate. I think there's one or two others who could certainly qualify for that description.
The pre-Romulans.
Yeah, the pre-Romulans.
They say they've annexed this planet in the name of something called the Romulan Star Empire.
Romulan. It's pronounced Romulan.
We're pleased to be joined by Tom Bevan, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics, and the man who's responsible for me running for mayor on the hashtag Cast for Mayor ticket. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Mr. Mayor. How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir. I'll have a news conference after our podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you, as always.
So is there enough going on in national politics to satisfy the Real Clear political brand?
Yes, there's plenty going on. It is a constant struggle. You know, it used to be in the good old days, John, you could expect that 5 o'clock Friday bad news dump, and everybody would go home for the weekend, and then we could, resume on Mondays. But now it's just nonstop all the time. And part of that is the president. He tweets Saturday mornings, Friday nights, Saturday nights, Sundays, doesn't matter. And part of it is just the news media itself now is just there are no deadlines, as you know. It's just a constant swirl of stuff, and part of that is social media, and it's just the day and age we live in. There's just it's never ending, you know, from the perspective of what we do, which is to try and absorb all this information, you know, make editorial judgments about it, synthesize it, and put out sort of the best of the best for people. It's become just a nonstop 24/7 slog. And you get a situation like the Kavanaugh hearings where what's been going on with that, where everybody has an opinion. I mean, there is just no, you know, and it's just a, it's a.
There are two opinions.
Well, we can talk about that more if you'd like. But
if you don't believe her, you're in the wrong opinion.
That certainly is the Democrats' position. And in fact, you know, Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii was on Sunday morning and said that, was asked point blank by Jake Tapper, you know, do you believe that Justice Kavanaugh is entitled to the same presumption of innocence as anyone else? And she basically said, if you listen to her answer, she said no, because she disagrees with him on policy, therefore his credibility suspect, therefore, you know, she believes the accuser before, you know, despite the fact that everyone that the accuser says was present or knew something about this alleged attack now denies it.
Three of her four, she had three witnesses as she spoke to the Washington Post. They've all denied it now. So where are we in a tweet? I think not tweet, but in a message to you on Twitter. I find that's where Tom and I communicate now. When we're not speaking, I asked you if this might be something of a deplorables moment. And the reason I ask it is because the country has changed now, or at least our politics have changed. If you accuse someone, they had to have, you had to come with evidence to convict them. Now people are convicted, like Kavanaugh, on the strength of one opinion that's fallen apart in terms of corroborating testimony, and still in the Democratic media complex, all the op-eds I read, and I see them on Real Clear elsewhere, but mostly elsewhere, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, it is, if you don't believe her, then you, too, are some sort of rapist or malcontent.
There certainly does seem to be on the Democrat side this willingness to sort of believe her full stop and disbelieve anything Kavanaugh says and to take her word at face value. I mean, there are a few problems with this, and it starts with the way that this was handled. If this was a claim that she made and wrote a letter to California Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, who then passed along to Dianne Feinstein, who then sat on it for 6-7 weeks. Throughout the hearing, throughout, her private meeting with Kavanaugh, she could have raised this concern at any time. They could have investigated it sort of in the normal course of the nomination hearing process. But what did she do? She waited until after the hearings were over. She refers it to the FBI, which is apparently
not their purview.
It's a 36-year-old allegation of an alleged attack, locally. Yes, the FBI included it in his background information. But so it was the way that this was handled by the Democrats on the committee, number one. Number two, the way that it's been handled by Ford herself and her lawyers. I mean, she comes out and says, yes, I'm willing to testify, I want to have a hearing. I want to tell my story. And Chuck Grassley says, okay, let's do it. you know, fly out here, sit before the committee, and then she appends all these crazy requirements and to
not only testimony. The camera, the one that really struck me was I'm the accuser, so I go last.
So I go last, which is unheard of, and right, it's
in the
outrageous.
History of common law and our law. Yeah,
exactly. Right. I mean, not you know. I mean, someone mentioned this. Not since the Spanish Inquisition have we been you know forcing people the accused to testify first. I mean, it just doesn't happen. It's absurd. But here she is dictating the process. She wants an FBI investigation. So it was kind of like, I want to testify. And Grassley says, okay. And then she says, no, wait, I want an investigation. And, you know, then she was, suddenly doesn't want to fly across the country. She, yeah, I mean, it's been one thing after another. Meanwhile, as we mentioned, we've had all these people who allegedly were witnesses, you know, to this attack or at the party or whatever, deny that it ever happened or that they were even there. And so you have, in the end, you have this situation where I think the Democrats, their insistence that you have to believe her and only her, otherwise you're, you know, railroading a you know, a victim of sexual abuse, et cetera, it's just, it's leaking oil like crazy right now. And,
it may be leaking oil, Tom, but that brings me back to the deplorables issue. Is this another deplorables? Because I think that there are many. My wife, I'll just take Betty, for example. She's married to a man. She's the mother of sons. She has brothers. And women in her situation like this, their men are now under the rules of the game as played by media and by the Democratic Party, stand guilty if accused of anything like this. It's like those college sexual harassment courts.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's a blowback.
This is a very interesting time politically. And to your point, I mean, CNN did an interview with these five women about the Kavanaugh allegations. You might have seen this clip. It was sort of bouncing around the internet during the course of the week, and they were all like, listen, I think the interviewer, the CNN host, was expecting them to be fully on board with the sort of Me Too, you know, I believe her mantra, and they were not at all, not even remotely. They were saying, look, this happened, you know, 36 years ago. It's her allegation. You know, this kind of stuff happened all the time, blah, 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 blah. So I do think there is an interesting dynamic there where the Democrats think that this really plays to their advantage, and they may be misreading parts of the electorate. As far as what electoral impact it might have, though, you know, I think it might energize Republicans a little bit who feel like Kavanaugh is being unfairly treated here. Democrats are already energized, and they clearly believe that she's being unfairly treated. And so their outrage meter is already at 11. It can't go any higher. But, you know, what do normal Americans, independent Americans think about this? Democrats might be surprised. The only thing is, are normal Americans, are average Americans, are they going to turn out and vote on November 6th, or are they going to stay home? That's really the big difference.
And I fall into that category of your independence, your outsider, because I don't vote party. I follow it, but I try to see the facts and lay the field. But this hearing that's going to coming up as we tape this on Thursday is going to be, you know, he said, she said, and there's no investigation here. And as much as I'd love to believe a victim and support them wholeheartedly with arms and be there for them, if there's no evidence, it's not going to sway my vote or sway the way I see this information. And, you know, it's something that may have happened, may not have happened, but without evidence, it becomes superfluous to everything that is actually going on. And I wanted to ask you, though, about the idea of initially the president came out on this and he was very controlled. His message was very much, hey, you know, this is terrible. If this is true, but we can't jump to conclusions. Let's get to the bottom of this. And then as the media coverage started to just eviscerate anybody who wasn't on her side, then you saw that the president kind of jump back and go back to his normal midnight tweeting about how dare, this is crazy, you're ruining this guy's life and all this stuff. And Tom, as you see it, somebody who takes in probably more media than anybody on the planet, How do you feel that the president is he falling into a trap that the media set for him, or do you think he's doing what he needs to do, or he's playing it the right way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, the speculation was that Trump getting back into this probably hurt Kavanaugh a little bit. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think a lot of this stuff, to your point, partisans are in their respective corners, as is with most things these days. So Trump tweeting, does that really hurt Kavanaugh that much? I don't know. I don't think so. It was interesting, though. And you had this guy, Ed Whalen from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, yep, put out this series of tweets a couple of days ago.
Whoa, yeah.
Which was where he sort of had this theory of the case that it was a mistaken identity. There was another party that happened, that sort of fit the parameters of what the accuser had said. And he basically fingered this eighth grade, middle school teacher who was a classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's at Georgetown Prep, which was wildly, reckless thing to do on Twitter. He apologized the next morning for, he said an appalling lack of judgment and basically went dark. I mean, it continues to astonish me how everybody who knows Ed Whalen and Carl Cannon, our Washington bureau chief, knows him. He's a well-known figure in Washington. Everybody, particularly in conservative circles, think he's very conservative, judicious, thoughtful.
He's
all
extremely
these things.
Thoughtful. He doesn't fly off a handle and do this.
And just lost his mind and went out there and did this. And whether that leads you to believe that this was something pre-planned and he was going to, basically blow up his entire career and his reputation to try and save Brett Kavanaugh or something, and open himself up to defamation suits and the like, be my guess, my guess to make those, promote those theories. But to me, it's just another example of how our politics is so crazy now that you have even people who are considered to be very thoughtful, prudent individuals losing their minds and saying and doing things. Just sort of shows that the Kavanaugh nomination is really the culmination of the craziness of our politics.
Yes, but also, I looked at Real Clear Politics the morning we taped this, and I see the lady from the New York Times, and many like her. The assumption is that because women have been treated poorly by men in the past, that anything said now is fact. And I'm just wondering about the long-term effects of that on not only our politics, but our republic. It's almost like, who said in the, I think from the Wall Street Journal, Dan Henninger, talking about the mob at a Roman Colosseum, thumbs up, thumbs down. Is that where we're going, or are we already there?
We're already there. I mean, and just to give you a sense, though, of the sort of capriciousness of this mob mentality, you have a guy like Al Franken, for example, who's drummed out of the Senate by his own members for being... I guess he kissed the woman in a way that she, he thought it was part of the play and she didn't. And so that offended her. And then this picture where he's sort of fake groping. He's not even actually groping her breasts. He's fake groping her breasts. Yeah, right. And that's enough to get him kicked out of the Senate. There was another allegation, I guess, that he had, at one point he had taken a photo with some people at the Minnesota State Fair and he had, grabbed her butt or something. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay. Meanwhile, you've got Keith Ellison now, who's running for attorney general of the state of Minnesota, who actually has a woman who's on the record, posted something, a medical record saying that she'd been verbally and physically abused. And he's a former member, leader of the DNC, a deputy of Tom Perez at the DNC.
He's number two Congressman at the DNC now.
Yeah. And he's like, crickets. I haven't heard a single Democrat call for him to get out of the race.
Crickets.
Now, I get that, the attorney general of Minnesota is not the same as a Supreme Court seat. Nevertheless, you go and look at there is a sort of arbitrariness to even among Democrats. And believe me, if either one of these guys had been Republican, there's a whole different standard for, it seems, for Republicans. So there's because it's impossible to separate this movement from politics and from the Trump era, because Trump is wrapped up in it with all of his allegations, et cetera, et cetera. So
yes,
it's in the bottom. And I've said this before to you, John. I mean, the bottom line is that there is no moral high ground anymore. For every, you know, for every Donald Trump, you can point back to Bill Clinton and say, you know, what about Juanita Broderick and all? I mean, there is. And so we should be relying on sort of a set of standards and rules that apply to everybody. And that's just long gone in the rearview mirror.
The short term is obviously a play for suburban women to tip the balance in the Senate elections and then pull Trump down and get rid of him. That's not really resistance. That's more like the establishment fighting, you know, the Death Star fighting the resistance. But the larger problem is that now every woman married to a man with boys like Betty, brothers, she's got to know that because of your, depending on their politics, her loved ones could be accused of terrible things and be destroyed. And I think that's larger than, to me personally, that's larger than party, larger than politics. It's almost like the stuff, how we live. And I think that's dangerous. And there should be a pushback, Tom, but I don't. If Donald Trump were William F. Buckley, I could see a pushback. I could see a president articulating and putting it together and basically throwing a touchdown pass before November. I don't see Trump able to do that.
No, Trump can't do it. I mean, he's not. He doesn't have the sort of facility with language and strategy. He's a blunt force object, right? He does not have the capacity to do that, nor does he. I mean, he has baggage that would prevent him from being the vehicle for making that argument. Listen, I get this. I have sons and a daughter, and so I have, my sympathies lie in both directions. I mean, I certainly, if something happened to her and she wanted to come forward and report it, I would want her to be heard. I would. My beef is not so much with this woman, you know, and I want her claims to be aired. I want them to be vetted. I want them to be scrutinized appropriately. My beef is with the way the Democrats have handled this process-wise.
Correct.
And what's gone on, and subsequently, I think, with Christine Ford's lawyers and the way they tried to hijack the process in the Senate with all these crazy demands that we need to, you know, Kavanaugh can't be in the room and she can't be questioned by a woman and, you know, she's got to go first, she's got to go last. I mean, those are the sorts of things that really bother me. Mm-hmm. If she's telling the truth, let her come forward, sit down, say the truth, and the truth will out. You know, Kavanaugh will sit down and say, give his defense, and guess what? One of them's going to look credible and hold up under scrutiny, and one of them is not. And let the public see it, and let the vote happen, and let's move on. But you know, as far as this being some big cultural moment, I mean, you go back and look that, and I hesitate to pin this all on Obama, but it certainly was the case that under the last president, the way that they handled Title IX claims, the way that they handled the stuff that went on campus, really gave fuel to the fire of this idea that, you know, we're going to have these sort of kangaroo courts, and it's, you know, you had a lot of situations where,
the boy was guilty before.
The boy was guilty. Presumed guilty
immediately.
Right. And we found out after the fact in from cases that didn't get much attention all the way up to
lacrosse.
Duke lacrosse, but even after that, the Rolling Stone article about the, you know, rape at the University of Virginia that
didn't happen.
There is sometimes a rush to judgment, and the way that they had set up these proceedings, it almost encouraged that. It put the presumption of guilt on the accused, and that's not the way we should be doing things.
And I'm going to throw this at the two of you because you've been doing this a lot longer than I have. But it's interesting. And every time we talk about these stories, credibility used to matter. And now people toss it to the wind because they don't seem to care. Is it different now? Do you feel like people in the media or someone like a, you know, this Ford, like she has lost credibility because she gave this to someone else.
She did not give it to the committee. If she had given it to the committee, she would be held legally responsible for her words. This was, as Tom mentioned, this was artfully played.
Right.
So that's why she doesn't want to stand up there and make a declaration. If you declare to the committee under oath, mm-hmm. there are consequences to not telling the truth.
Right.
Well, you know, we heard there's a tentative deal for her to testify, and it looks like it's going to be now on Thursday. You know, we'll see what happens. I mean, I honestly, the way this has gone, and, you know, with all these demands, I would not be surprised if she did not testify. And because if her claims are not going to hold up, then, you know, the storyline for the Democrats would be, well, look at the Republicans have you know, they've bullied a sexual abuse victim, won't let her tell her story. They're going to put a rapist on, you know, on the Supreme Court. And by the way, vote for us on November 6th.
And that'll be it. Yeah,
that would be in the most cynical scenario. If you assume this was sort of a political partisan setup from the get go. That would sort of be the end point if you play that out. I think there's a possibility that that's the case. I mean, we'll see what goes on. The fact that all these people that she said were there denied that they... Under oath that they were there or that they were doing whatever. I know she passed a polygraph test. She says she passed a polygraph test. We'll see how this plays out, but it is very uncertain. And, you know, maybe she'll testify and it'll be this, you know, massive media circus.
Of course it will be.
At the end of the day, we'll probably be left, if she does testify, we're going to be left right where we are right now, which is he said, she said, what are you going to do?
The Supreme Court will be discredited. Now, because forevermore, some will say there's a rapist on the court. And that... weakens the republic. And the second thing I see, the media itself, I've seen people, there are people who write only with pure emotion, and they're soft and cuddly, and then they get upset, and it's all emotion, men and women. And for those people, I say I can't really criticize them because they're childlike, you know what I mean, and their publications publish what they say. But there are others who know better, who understand process, Tom, and understand politics. And to see them playing that game, it is... You ran my column of a couple last week or so about the McCarthy hearings, and I could just see people on the right playing the same type of, you know, game where they cater to the mob and inflame the mob for their own popularity, and it's really depressing.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned Dianne Feinstein in your column, you know, where's your sense of decency? I mean, this is also another example of, you know, Dianne Feinstein has had this long career of you know, that very well regarded across the aisle. She's worked with Republicans in the past. She's been sort of a model of civility and prudence on most issues. She's not one to sort of get hysterical or jump the gun or go for any of these, you know, crazy underhanded partisan stunts that some senators play. And yet here she is in her 85th year running for re-election against someone who is way to her left. She didn't get her nomination at the state convention. She is under fire from liberal activists and the sort of, you know, rank and file of her party. And she's the center of this. She's part of the problem because of the way she handled this, the timing of this, and this allegation, the whole thing.
The dogma.
It's unfortunate, but it is where, you know, we are where we are. And Dianne Feinstein is a perfect example of how things used to be and how things are now.
The dogma lives within her, speaks loudly within her.
She may get another crack at that if Kavanaugh goes down. I would not be surprised if Trump turns around and nominates Amy Barrett. And then we'll see if Democrats have the Senate or not and what happens. Maybe she'll be the judiciary chairman interviewing Amy Barrett for the Supreme Court. And that'd be fun, wouldn't it?
That would be something. And that's what people are saying, you know, that it's funny because people who are middle, you know, not the far left, but say the far left, you've got to tamp it down. You got to let this roll out because Kavanaugh is a sensible pick as far as the left is concerned. And if he goes down, Trump goes ballistic and nominates, like you said, Barrett, or even goes even crazier. And like, who knows where he goes with it.
If he gets Barrett and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, I can die a hippie. Tom Bevin, Real Clear Politics, president of that and co-founder and publisher, and also the man who got me in the mayor's race.
How's the campaign going? How's the campaign going?
Ever since you had me on the Tom Bevin show on WLS Radio, which runs on Sundays at 8 o'clock, I was inundated with true believers.
Yeah. Yeah. The Cast Juggernaut is on track for victory in February, is that?
Yes, I think the debt, I shall raise the debt.
Only Kanye can stop you.
We'll see.
Thanks, all right, Tom. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Tom.
You bet.
I'd like to thank Paul Vallis. Now his knuckles are a little broken after he punched Krapnik and Chico in the mouth.
That's the Paul Vallis I want running.
Yeah, I want that. I want that in all of them. And I also want to thank, we also want to thank Tom Bevin of Real Clear Politics for coming on, always giving us some great insight because he does see all this stuff from all different angles. For Jeff Carlin of WGN's Rokan with Anna Devolani show, he's the executive producer and the genius behind this sound. And for me, John Cass, thanks for visiting with us on the Chicago Way. Come back again. We'll make sure the streets streetlights are on this time.